back to An Alien in Hollywood. I'm Harry Duran, and I'm here with my co-host, Robin Maxwell.
Hello.
So, Robin, we're picking up the thread from episode one, and I want to take us to 1979, the year that Alien was released. Did you already know Ron by then?
No. I was a recent transplant from New York. I'd been here a couple years, where I'd had a painfully failed acting career. And at that point, I had no conscious idea I was ever going to be a professional writer, though in truth, I had moved myself directly to Hollywood, so that maybe there was something subconscious going on. And like so many other wannabes, I'd started trying my hand at some screenplay treatments and a couple of feature film spec scripts. And like everybody else in the previous decade, I had had my mind completely blown by this new breed of sci-fi movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Star Wars and 2001, A Space Odyssey. But by 1979, when I went to see Alien, it was just beginning to dawn on me that I had a specific interest that was already bordering on obsession in extraterrestrials and lost civilizations. And like you, when I first saw Alien and it blew me away, I had no idea that one day, in my case, it was less than 4 years later, I would be meeting one of its creators. And not only meeting him, but that eventually we would become collaborators in books and movies and TV series and even a podcast involving what else? Atlantis and aliens. I also had no idea that one day Ron and Linda would rent a truck, fight their way past a police barricade, and rescue my husband and me from the Topanga Malibu fire. We have quite a history together, the four of us.
Let's go back to 1978. At this point, Dan O'Bannon and Ron had managed to survive their first close encounter with Hollywood, pun intended, and both had been allowed by 20th Century Fox onto Ridley Scott's movie set.
Which is certainly not a fait accompli for most screenwriters. We are generally at the extreme bottom of the food chain. So being sent to England was already a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, Dan was there as a consultant and set designer, and Ron's title was actually executive producer.
So we have two complete neophyte screenwriters storming the London set of a major motion picture, which is mind-boggling.
I think that's the perfect segue into episode two. So without further ado, here is An Alien in Hollywood, Alien Part Two, Nostromos, A Very Bloody Birth.
So you go to England, you go to Shepperton Studios.
Yeah.
And they're starting to build the sets, right?
Right, starting to build the sets, but Dan and I aren't there yet.
Want to talk about that and your experiences during the pre-production?
Okay. Well, the first place, we got the sets for a miracle because Giger, they want nothing to do with. He was an unknown, crazy guy that painted pictures and just horrifying sets. And when we showed Ridley, though, the drawings that Giger made, he said, okay, that's it. We snicked the drawings to him. We weren't even supposed to show them to anybody. So he says, we're going to do this. I said, no, Fox, they won't do it. Maybe you can. Oh, I'll get them to do it. Why? Because I'll say I'm going to quit. Either it's these screen giggers or it's nothing. And they didn't have any other director. And I said, don't tell them we gave you this drawing. Oh, no, I'll tell them I accidentally got it. So that's what he did. He went to said, no, you got to use this guy, Giger. And they kept telling him, don't even mention his name. We're going to fire you. And they go, oh, my God, how did this happen? They already had the walls covered with these mediocre other designers that just cliches, designs of science fiction was nowhere near the breakthrough movie. Even without Giger, it wouldn't have been the breakthrough movie that was. But I have to say, on behalf, later, when they came and the sets were being built, I got to give them credit for this. They came, you know, it was in London, we shot it. So the sets were there. And after Ridley convinced them, you have to go back to all Giger's designs, forget all these others. Laddie and the others came and they visited the set. And see these sets 60 feet tall, and they were looking, oh my God, we were wrong. These sets belong in the Museum of Modern Art. What fools we were.
Can you talk a little bit about the casting?
Ridley cast it. I had nothing to do with the casting. Even all the other actors, he said, I'm going to cast it with every Shakespearean actors. Yoffit and Harry Dean were his character actors everybody loved. And he said, you know what, I'm going to do this. I'm not good with actors. I'm too involved with the visual. So I'm going to director-proof cast it. I'm going to cast it so they don't need any help from me to get the performance. I have them say a word, and they're going to be great at it. They'll get it without me. And that's what I'm good at. And so that's why he cast all these people. He said, they're all so brilliant, they don't need any help performance. Most people, you look for the director to help you with the performance.
I heard that it was only about 3 weeks before the start of principal photography when they started casting it. And how did Sigourney Weaver come into it? But what are your memories about that?
No name do it. They tried. They went to Candy Bergen, Jane Fonda, all the named female of that age. And stars didn't like it. Didn't they said it's this silly movie, a robot and a big lizard out of your chest. They didn't want to do it. So Sigourney got it by giving a brilliant reading. She was off Broadway and a hit. And they gave her a cold reading and she knocked it out of the park.
Ron, I understand there was some friction between Sigourney and the rest of the cast.
They all hated her because she had no experience except off Broadway. And they were all proven. They were character actors, but they were all proven at their craft. And they thought, what's this? She has no background. She's the... Because the way she acts, it's inward, you know, and that's good. Like Gary Cooper used to be like, you'd see it on the screen, but on the stage, it seemed like she wasn't doing much. They thought through the half of the movie, they thought she was terrible until everybody started saying, oh, she's amazing. And they said, that's it. That's our girl. So she got it on talent. And then she did all these other great things after that.
But didn't they also try to kick you off?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They took away... Giler and Hill were so angry, and I drove a deal that I had to be not only executive producer, but our version of the script, but that I had to be there during the filming, pay me per diem, and my salary was tiny, but per diem for me to live there through the making of it. And about a third of the way through the movie, my per diem ran out because I had only signed for about a third, and they would renew it if everything was working with me. But we lived in Chelsea, and the studio was 45 minutes away. So a chauffeur had to take me there 45 minutes. But when Giler and Hill said, okay, we got to sabotage Ron. He sees he's got control. How can we get him out here? We'll point out that you have to take his money away because his contract's up unless you decide to renew it. We're going to take away his transportation, his living money in Chelsea, and he has to go back because he can't afford it. I didn't have my own money. So they did that. Well, first, they didn't take away my apartment money. They took away my transportation. I had to get up every morning at 5 o'clock and take a subway. It took 3 hours. Limousine took 45 minutes. So I was afraid to say anything to the studio back in Hollywood. I'd be a troublemaker. So as long as Ridley and I had the power, I didn't want to put Ridley in the middle. He might be challenged and might have to let me go. So I didn't say a word. So it happened by accident. Saved me. When I took the subway... You couldn't get to the studio. It was a half-hour walk through the woods. There was no cabs. So I would just walk in the morning. No one knew, you know, what was happening, except the AD knew. So one day, Ridley's looking for me. So Ridley says, where's Ron? He said, oh, he's walking through the woods. Well, what do you mean he's walking through the woods? He says, well, he can't get it. There's no cabs. He takes a subway. What do you mean? No, they took away his number. What? I got to talk to Alan Ladd right away. So he gets on the phone. He says, look, I'm quitting. What do you care? Because I need Ron here. I don't need him walking through the woods. I don't need him to take a subway here. I need him here. I'm not shooting their version. I'm shooting Ron and Dan's version. So they go, oh, okay, all right. So they fixed it all up. They gave me back my transportation and everything. I was afraid if I had told them, maybe it would have got me, okay, got two war. In fact, we'll just get rid of all of both of them. So Fox had to accept that because if you've got to go with that director, you can't force him to do something totally opposite of the way he wants to do it. Then what happened was we actually started shooting. That's when something really dramatic happened that further enhanced my position. This was during the shooting, the first third of the shooting. And I'm there and they're not, and they're shooting my version. So it seems like everything's going to be great, right? As far as I felt. But in the first third of the shooting, you look at the dailies, you know, and it wasn't working. Even though it was the exact script I wanted to shoot, and the sets were amazing, and Fox had said, oh, yeah, thank God we let you convince us of this. Ridley's a perfect director for it. And after we shot about the first third of the movie, It was not working. I noticed every day I saw more dailies. For some strange reason, the movie wasn't, even by my thinking, and they were doing everything I wanted to do. And so I said, Jesus, the movie doesn't seem to be working. It's slow and plodding. It's the right version of the script, but it's the pacing is off. It's just funereal instead of suspenseful. And that's what I felt from looking at the dailies every, you know, for a month or so. So, but I could get off the picture by saying, especially when they're shooting when I want them to shoot. So finally, I said to Ridley, I think the movie isn't working, but I know why. He said, what do you mean? Well, it's too slow. And he said, well, Ron, I don't want it to be a fast-paced action movie. It's just like The Omen. It's like, and I said, yeah, but it can't drag. It's got to be that way, but not drag and drag, or it won't be a good version of The Omen. And he said, no, I think you think that, Ron, because you've never been in the making of a movie. You're looking at the shots being done over and over. I said, you know, really, you could be right. But I think you're wrong, and I know a way to find out for both of us sake. And he says, how? I said, time what we've filmed so far. Edit together and time it. If I'm right, it'll be about a third too much running time, and the movie will be 3 hours long. If you're right, I'm wrong. It's not too slow. It just appears to me because I've never been a part of the making a movie. So he says, great, we'll type it. Times, and he comes to me, he says, you must be a witch. It comes out exactly about a 3 hour movie if I shot the rest of it at this pace. Okay, so what do you suggest? You have I said, yes, I have a very good suggestion about everything we've shot. No problem. We should just cut out some of this footage. Shoot, we don't have to shoot any scenes over, just edit them differently. Oh, he shows the studio, and they said the same thing. It was too slow, Ridley. We were afraid to tell you because we didn't want to have to fire you. But he's right. Ron's right. He said, Ron says it's too slow. He's right. And they said, you know why we believe it? Because your baby, you and Dan. If you want to cut 15 pages of your own script, that doesn't usually happen. I was an amateur, but I just had the born aptitude for it. So from then on, I had a huge input on what the movie would be. Ridley would keep me right next to him, and if I felt it wasn't going wrong, he would speed it up, you know. So that accidentally, if things hadn't gone wrong in the first third, and I was the one that realized it and why, I never would have got as much say over the movie as I had. Even though they were already shooting my draft, they weren't shooting the right pacing. And that was easy to fix. You had Ridley's genius visual, but at the right pacing now, and the whole movie was coming together the way it eventually did. And that gave me the power.
Didn't you have one more suggestion?
Actors have to pick up their cues faster, and they got to move. This is a creature trying to kill him. Move through the corridors faster, like there's urgency. Ask him to show you what we should do. So I said, yeah, so we have to cut 15 pages out of the script that we've already committed to. Can you do that? Yeah, I can cut 15 pages. We'll lose some exciting scenes, but not there's so much there. But then the rest of the movie will come at 2 hours. Your ruling is you don't want to do it longer than 2 hours. I usually lose a whole screening a day if it's longer than that. And so by then, the studio is more and more faith in me and Dan, because it's our version, especially me, because I'm there making producing decisions, and Dan isn't. He's making decisions on the visual. So everybody's getting more faith in me. They said, okay, do what Ron suggests. Let's see what happens. Let's pick up the cues faster, walk down the corridors, go to another set to shoot part of that scene, and try it for a few days. So he said, I'm going to do that. And he does it. And at the end of a few days, he shows Fox this, and they said, that's fantastic. The movie looks much better already.
Did Sigourney or any of the other actors have any input on the script?
Not until about midway, when there was a great crisis developed with the actors. Other than that, they were all not named stars. They were all proven successes as character actors, but none of them could be prima donnas. But halfway through, there became an incredible crisis with the whole cast. They almost all quit. And we got to a scene with a robot. You think he's a robot, his head comes off, and they hook up his head with a wire, and they're talking to it. That scene started to play disastrous, and filming it. It was playing real bad, okay? It was all discordant with the rest of the movie, but there was a reason. Giler and Hill wrote that scene. It was the only thing left that they wrote. But they said, come on, Ron's getting everything he wants. We got to have this. And this home office, they said, all right. Well, so then they said, well, Ron, that scene wasn't even my idea. Mine's your dad. It was their idea, and they wrote it. And they said, well, Ron, we're a little worried. What do you feel about this scene? I said, it's great. The scene, and they said, you really think it's not your scene? I said, you need it. They said, well, we're afraid that it'll distract. You got a monster movie, then you got a robot that's the villain. I said, it'll work perfect. And they said, really? Why do you think? I said, because you have nothing in this last third of the script that's anything as amazing as a chest burster. Now you got this guy whose head is knocked off, but he's really a robot. You don't know it. So it won't be a one pony movie. There had to be something near as amazing. And that's it. The robot's near as amazing. Well, you think it'll conflict because he's the monster and there's a regular monster and he's the, and it's, no, it's perfect. The company set him up, say, let everybody die if they have to, just bring back the creature because we need that specimen. And that works. And it doesn't matter if you shift emphasis on him because you still got the monster as a main, but you've got something for the last third that's unique and also amazing visually, the whole thing. You said, okay. But then when I said, it's not written right. And they said, well, we can't. Guyler and Hill will have a nervous breakdown if we say, use their idea, but you want to rewrite. I said, okay, I can't force that upon you. So we'll try and fix an editing. We get to shooting this scene, and it's terrible because the way they wrote it. They don't have a grasp on science fiction. And it wasn't working, and I could see it, but I couldn't dare say that. Well, now I want to rewrite it, you know, or I'd be getting thrown off the movie. So they're shooting it the way they wrote it. Now, I agreed it was a brilliant idea, and it helped the movie, but it just need. I couldn't say, let me rewrite it. The one scene they created, I wanted to rewrite. So I had to forget about this. So we're shooting it. Halfway through shooting, maybe it takes several days. About 2 days in it, the cast starts getting upset. And I felt it was rewritten, but I didn't say a word to them because I could only get myself. Actors saying, Ron is trying to get us to do this, rewrite it. Couldn't have that be said in the cast. But I started rebelling. They all started saying, this is terrible. Ron, can't you see this is terrible? I said, well, maybe it needs a small polish. No, it's terrible. The idea's great, but it's not working. How come everything else is? They didn't know that it was the only scene I didn't write. They said, how come everything else you and Dan wrote is great and this scene's crap? So Ridley thought I put him up to it because he knew I felt there were problems with it, even though the concept was good. So I thought you would put him up to it until they started blaming you. Ron, what's the matter with you? Can't you see it doesn't work? You got to rewrite it. So then Ridley called me and said, okay. And they said, this is terrible. We're not going to finish shooting this scene. They went into a palace rebellion, right? We're going to stop. You can't throw us all off. The whole cast is going to put in our heels. We're not going to finish the movie. And they said, well, you use your SAG card. We don't care. You know, and so there's seven people. None of them are stars. But you can't do the rest of the movie. Replacing them all. Got the first two-thirds. So Ridley said, Ron, listen, we got a crisis here. Okay, I'm going to try this on you. You say you know why they hate the scene, even though it's a great idea. Scene's not written right. And also, to make it worse, people from the executive from Hollywood were there watching it. If they saw me, Guyler and Hill were there, and they were there, if they saw me seeking control and rewriting the scene, they'd probably throw me off the movie. So whatever the actors, maybe we'll change it, netting something. So Ridley calls me aside. He says, Ron, listen, the actors feel the way you do, and this is getting to be a crisis. I'm losing control of the movie. It's chaotic. We can't finish it without them. Supposing, now they're not going to be here till 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, the executives from Hollywood. He says, well, what if I told you to stay all night? There are guards here. I give you about 5 stenographers, and you feel that you can fix what's wrong. I said, yeah, I'm positive. You really? I think I can fix it in one night? Yeah, I can fix it in one night. I know just what they don't like about it. It's the things I don't like about the way it's written. Okay, I'm going to leave you here. We're going to meet at 5 in the morning before the executives from Fox can get here, before Guyler and Hill can get here. And you're going to rewrite the scene, and we're going to shoot it before they get here, and we're going to tear down the set so they can't change it. And so I said, okay, really, that sounds good. Okay, I hope you're not feeling too much. No, I said, I've been thinking about it for weeks, how to fix it. Okay, so they left me there. I rewrote the whole thing easily. Dan wasn't there. And the next day, they get there at 5 in the morning. He shows them all, and there's 6 or 7 people involved, right? I said, well, we can't, maybe some of them won't like it as much as I do. It's not one actor, that's easy. You got to make sure all of them are on board, at least stop threatening to quit in the middle of the movie. So they read it in 20 minutes, and they all say, this is fantastic. Ron fixed it. So really, okay, we're shooting it. We're shooting it at night, and they won't know anything about it, and we tear down the sets first thing in the morning before they get here. And that's it. The only way they can get it out is to throw it out of the movie, the whole thing. God. So we did that. And when they got there, no, we already shot. What? Yeah, what about the set? We tore down that set. Well, you can't do it another? No, we can't. There's nowhere else we can set it. It's too late. You have to rebuild it. You're just going to have to see what we did, and if you hate it, you'll edit it out of the movie. But if you don't, that's it. That's the way Ron rewrote it. So they were just fuming, of course. I would have gotten thrown off the movie, except it was Ridley's idea that we shoot it at night and tear it down. He said, I know I'm risk, but they can't replace me that easier either. It would be a tremendous blow to the movie. They'd think the whole movie's in trouble. So that was part by accident. The cast saved me.
That's a fantastic story. I've never heard that one. But now let's get to what everybody's interested in. Let's talk about the chestburster scene.
One of the most exciting and interesting parts was the chestburster scene, the filming of it. That was an amazing aspect, the actual filming of it. Now, the cast, I'll see it's in the script, right? But they thought it was going to be done later in post-production in special effects. They didn't realize that it was going to be done live as they watched it on set. Because oftentimes, special effects are done at the end. So Ridley had this brilliant idea. So I tell you what we're going to do. John Hurt collapses on the table. He says, he collapses. That's the last thing they see. Then we hide all the actors upstairs. They don't see what's going on. John Hurt gets under the table. It's had sides on it. You couldn't see. Sticks his head up through a body. It's a hollow body. It's not him. But the cast thinks it's him. This thing happens. We got a guy with a hand puppet. He's under there, too. You just see up to his wrist, but the little creature's on it. There's another guy with a cylinder with blood pumping through the artificial veins of the hollow body. And they don't, body bursts open. They bought butcher parts hot. It smelled bad. It would look like organs of a human. Yeah, but it's in there. And this happens as they're watching it, but they don't understand why it's so realistic.
At this point, none of the cast was prepared for what was going to happen.
No. They thought it would be done later. They had no idea. They thought this is a script. Later, they'll do all these effects, and it won't have anything to do with the real. It'll be done, dummied up all specially. It'll take hours in each thing. Nothing will happen here on stage we're watching. But then Sigourney knew it. She guessed it. She didn't know it. But all of a sudden, she says to me, I said, Sigourney, you... and she's all tensed up. I said, boy, you're really in character. She said, I'm not in character. I'm afraid. I said, what do you mean? What do you mean? It's a movie. I said, like Hitchcock. It's a movie, Ingrid. I said, what do you mean? She said, I know what you guys are up to. I swear to God, I saw you and Dan. We were all across the state, and you had cellophane-like umbrellas, clear umbrella hoods on you because there's going to be a lot of blood spray, and you don't want it to get on you. And it's going to happen right now, isn't it? It's going to look real, and there's going to be blood spurting. And you and Dan look like it's Christmas Day has come. It's your big scene, and it's going to be ghastly. I said, yeah, but don't tell the others, you know. Okay, so she didn't say a word. And then we unleashed it, and we never had to do a separate take because they were all so horrified. Angela Cartwright fainted. She really, because she got hit in the air with blood and she saw the body opening, she passed right out, you know, and Offutt, you know, 6'4", he picks up, you know, the salad, the wooden, get away, that creature, get away from me. And he starts going crazy, you know, and they're all just going nuts. We never had to do another take of their reactions. We had to do a couple of other takes when we made them up again of the bursting, but not the actors. And that one take, they were all so horrified. And then I became friendly with Yoffit at that time, his wife. And so his wife said to me about a few days later, she said, for a week, he'd go in his room and brood. He was so scared. After that, he said, I'll believe anything's going to happen on this movie. Oh, my God, I've been in the war, but I've never seen a goddamn thing like that. A guy's chest opens up, creature comes right out of it, and we're watching it. And he says, I couldn't understand what was going on. I thought it was an accident. Remember, Bruce Lee's son died because a bullet cut. I thought something went wrong. They cut the guy open. So from then on, they were so terrified because the whole cast realized, okay, this movie is going to have more impact than any movie in years. And from then on, they were really scared that, of that monster. Their performances showed it. They saw why, but still they said this was infused them such fear because it wasn't so shortly after it came out that it was stalking them. From then on, in every scene, they looked terrified, you know, and that made it twice as good.
Was it shot somewhat chronologically? You did the chestburster, and then each of the crews started being killed?
Yes, yes. We saw, we did, the sets were on three floors. The rockets, the spaceship had three different levels, and each different sound stage had a whole level. And so we shot it very much like a real life, like it would, what would happen on that floor is what was supposed to happen on the spaceship level. And so it seemed like we were doing it. It seemed, it just got very believable and real, and it became, I think they all realized then it's become a classic.
How much time had you spent up until that point working with actors?
You mean these actors? I'd made no movies, so zero. But so much came out of my gut. It was left to me to convey our mutual feelings about what the performance should be, and really didn't want to be. And so it was a perfect combination. Since the death of Kubrick, I don't think there's been as brilliant, with all the young, brilliant stylists, I don't think any of them are as equal to Ridley to this day. And the movies he's made since then shows that. He was a genius visually. But one of the great things I left out was another terrific thing in the making of the movie. Okay, it was the 15-foot-tall creature sitting in a chair, and he's got something in front of him, some kind of a weapon or a observing thing, and the walls are 60 feet tall, and they look like somehow like the inside of a whale's body, but a little different. Their bones, their shape weird, and the eggs are in the floor above them. It cost about $2 million to do this one shot, and they come up to it. They look and they see this creature, and we shot that. Well, they give it to me. We shot kids in spacesuits, so it would be even bigger and look like the cast, but you couldn't tell it. But essentially, you'd have it almost as big as it's supposed to be. And I kept saying, you need this, so the movie's never going to have the impact you want it to have. And so they said, well, I don't think we can give you that, Ron. We're giving you everything you want. We can't give you that. And I said, well, you got to have that. What do you mean you have to have it? I said, you're not going to have an epic movie. I said, well, you're telling us it's not going to be as big a hit. What, this one scene? I said, I'll tell you why. That's your Cecil B. DeMille shot. You got to have the walls. You got to have this creature. You can't suggest it in the dirt or something. When they see that, they'll know this is the most amazing movie, one of the most amazing they've ever seen. If you don't have that, it's going to be schlock little movie that's trying to be a big movie. You feel that? I said, yeah, I'm positive. So I didn't hear any more about it. And the next thing I know, we're shooting other things. I'm doing an errand across the studio where that's supposed to take place. And I see it's almost built. The thing the set and the creature, they're building it. I said, they lost communication somehow. They gave it to us and they don't know they're not supposed to give it. So I don't say a word. You know, I said, okay. And then comes time to shoot it. And we're about a few days away. And we're going to go and move to the others. I said, you built the set. So you said you wouldn't give us. Yeah. Well, we didn't want to tell you we'd give you that, because then you'd never stop asking for anything. It was like anything you want, anything. So we said, we're going to hide it from you. Ridley knows. You don't know. The cast doesn't know. And that's why we did it. When you started saying it's not going to be a huge hit if you don't do this, we had the fear of God put in us.
So tell me a little bit more about the nursery set where all the 130 eggs were.
Okay, that was a similar set, which they used it twice. They used it first for that, and then they repeated it for the other. When they actually built it, then they used it for that. But the notable thing about that was we couldn't get the egg opening right. It looked stupid. It looked embarrassing. When they opened up and jumped on his face.
I heard at first one of the first designs, it was a Catholic cross, and then another time it looked like a vagina, and they just kept trying.
Kept trying, and it was laughable. Every time we looked at the screening of the special effect and how it affected one of the actors used it, it looked laughable. We were laughing. So we thought we'd never get it, but Ridley kept shooting it until it just worked perfect. It opened up and jumped in his face. One of the biggest cheers in the whole audience when we screened it. But we kept thinking, this is making fools of us. How can we do something like this but get it right? We shot it about 7 times, and about the 7th time, it worked perfect. And when it showed it to the audience, that was one of the biggest audience reactions ever. So it was his visual genius and Giger's about the design working and the execution of it opening up. We thought, we didn't know we were going to have to do something else instead of that.
And of course, that was the transitional scene. It was the first contact with
right. The
facehugger onto the face helmet, the face plate.
Right.
And then you had to figure out how you were going to get the impregnation. And what was the answer to that?
Okay, well, that's when I suggested that's what it be when we in script form. How the alien gets on board? It puts this tube on him, and it's giving him. They said, well, look, it's giving him air, and we don't know what it's doing inside, but it's keeping him alive. And if we take it off, he might die. And they said, okay, well, we're going to have to try it because it's on his face, and he can't go through the rest of his life with that. And so we came up with it'll look ghastly, the sting in his face. And when we take it off, they'll realize he's still living, but they'll realize that it did something to him inside. And then when they don't know what, it bursts right out of his chest. When they're not sure. X-rays didn't show anything because the ink came and covered the X-rays, so they couldn't see what was going on.
And what about that wonderful moment when they cut one of the legs off the face hugger?
Right.
It came out like acid, green acid.
Right. That was already in the script. We had that it would bleed acid. That was it's a wonderful defense mechanism. You don't dare kill it.
This is the end of episode 2 of An Alien in Hollywood. We're not quite finished with principal photography yet, so in episode 3, we're going to hear more about that, in particular about the adult alien creature, which is, without a doubt, the most terrifying monster in the history of film. We're also going to hear about the first screenings of the movie to test audiences and their reactions to it, and the release of the film to the public and its reception. But we are also going to hear a little known tidbit about the crucial role of Steven Spielberg and George Lucas in the success of the movie. You're not going to want to miss it. So here's Robin Maxwell and Harry Duran signing off.